For those of you out there who aren't in the creative arts, something you might not know is that sometimes you make things because you have a passion for them, and sometimes you make things for money. But there are some instances in which you create something simply because it's occupying a lot of real estate in your brain, and you need to clear out that space in your mental hard drive for something new. That's the case with this show. It wasn't the show I had planned, but I just kept getting drawn back to it. It kept coming back around to my consciousness like a cursed penny. And that isn't to say that this show is bad or it's good or it's anything like that. I hope that everything I do is good and stimulating and entertaining, but ultimately, it isn't me who makes that call. It's you guys. But this show, I need this show out of my head so that I can do other shows. I need to defragment my mental hard drive. Does that make sense? I hope so. Because it turns out that I'm not quite done with the concept of time travel. After a couple of conversations with some of you wonderful time bandits out there, I've decided to squeeze every last drop out of this premise that I can. So here, once more under the breach, another time travel show.
It's Historygo time.
As we established in the last show, if you ever found yourself traveling back in time, maybe the best option you had was to not kill Adolf Hitler. And if you haven't listened to the last show, then I highly recommend that you go and do that now, because context is really, really important when you say something like, maybe don't kill Hitler.
Hans, are we the baddies?
But if you did travel back in time, obviously you can't shoot Hitler, but what could you do? Surely there are ways in which you can benefit from the rather unique position you found yourself in. Surely you can use time travel to your advantage. Well, you bet your sweet bippy you can. Pull up a seat and let Damo walk you through the ways in which you can become the most important person who has ever lived. And if you're listening to this show after having traveled back in time, now's a great point to hit pause and then go and pick up a slab of wet clay or something so that you can write all of this stuff down, because I don't get to electricity until the second half of the show, and charging your phone might become problematic. So the inevitable has happened. You got your hand caught in a toaster, you tried to fix it, and suddenly you found that you're the first non-Brazilian to travel backward through time. It was bound to happen eventually.
Correction, Homer. You're the second.
That's right, Mr. Peabody!
Quiet, you.
And the first person to travel through time, at least according to The Simpsons, was, of course, Carlos Castaneda, but that's a story for another time. But at least now you know the full history of the most obscure joke in The Simpsons. So you've got your hand caught in the toaster. You've fallen down the trousers of time. You've jumped in the phone booth. You've got the DeLorean to 88 miles an hour. Is there any way for you to use your future knowledge to win friends and influence people?
Calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious shit.
Here we go. Damo's Guide to Time Travel. Oh, and of course, for all of this, a quick disclaimer. You are probably going to be murdered because people will think that you're some kind of warlock. That's just bound to happen, so just sort of keep that in mind. Inevitable murder. But here we go. Damo's Guide to Time Travel. First off, you're gonna have a language problem. Actually, no. Depending on how far back you've traveled through time, that might actually be the least of your concerns. If you've gone back billions of years, you're in proper trouble. You're not exactly gonna have an atmosphere to breathe. If you've gone back millions of years, then you are going to be eaten by a dinosaur. That sucks, but at least there's the fact that the Earth has a much higher concentration of oxygen back then, so at least you'll be tripping balls when the raptors show up.
Clever girl.
But let's keep this confined to human history and human civilization. First off, you're gonna have a language problem. That one cannot be solved, I'm sorry. And that doesn't really matter how far you go back. If you went back 2,000 years, you can probably scrape by if you know a little bit of Latin, but any time else is going to give you some problems. Hell, it's only about 500 years back in the past that nobody will speak a form of English that you'll be able to recognize, so even traveling backward in time through England is going to be an issue, let alone anywhere else in the rest of the world. 500 years ago, English does not sound like anything we'd recognize today. For instance, here's the first line of the Lord's Prayer as we know it today. Lord's Prayer, something we all know and we can all be familiar with. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Simple, right? It's a little on the flowery side, nobody says art or thine anymore, but we know what they're going for. Now, let's go with that same line, but we're in the 1400s in England. Lord's Prayer. Fader ure, thithu art in huvane, sit in nama gehallud.
Pie Jesu Domine, dona eis requiem.
So yeah, English is going to be a problem for us English speakers today. Middle English does not sound like English. Your best bet is going to be the time-honored classic of immersing yourself in the local culture and learning yourself the lingo. You know, the way babies do it.
You know what really aggravates me? Is them immigrants. They want all the benefits of living in Springfield, but they ain't even bothered to learn themselves the language.
Yeah, those are exactly my sentimonies.
Yeah, well,
you shut it, Bon.
It'll take some time. But fortunately, you've got all the time in the world. And this goes for pretty much all languages, too. You run into the same problem if you're talking in, say, Greek, which you think would give you at least 3,000 years worth of play. Conic Greek and modern Greek are two very different things, but the same sort of lexical evolution takes place. So you're going to have to learn the language. That sucks, and it's going to set you back a few years, but it's not insurmountable. Find someone important and tell them that English becomes the lingua franca in the future and watch them lose their shit because it's not a romance language. That itself is worth the price of admission alone. But we're not here to piss people off. We're here to become famous for inventing things. So here we go. First things first, you might want to set the benchmark for all other inventions. That seems like a good place to start, right? The absolute go-to benchmark for one of the greatest inventions ever. And to do that, you'll need to have landed somewhere before 1928. And what you do is, basically, you get a bunch of kitchen knives lined up in a row, 1.27 centimeters apart. Don't encourage people to use imperial units, centimeters are objectively better. Once you've got your knives all set up in a row, get a machine to vibrate them back and forth. Then, drop a loaf of bread on there, and bam! You've just invented sliced bread. Everything after this will be relegated to best thing since this. You've set the benchmark for all other inventions. Of course, you've just destroyed the life work of Otto Friedrich Rohwedder and shat all over his dreams, but it's his fault for inventing sliced bread instead of a time machine. Sucks to be him. But as much as the idioms would love to have you believe that sliced bread is important in the grand scope of human civilization, it really isn't. We got by for a long time by slicing it the old-fashioned way, and we were just fine. We didn't travel through history to nickel and dime shit. We're here to be the best damn inventors ever. So we need to travel back even further. And to do basically anything invention-wise, first off, you're going to need to invent maths. I know, the dreaded mathematics. Normally, I'd say that this would be hard, because advanced mathematics has existed for thousands of years, but you're going to be catching a lucky break for once. Because Western history only cares about Western history, which means that you only have to beat the Greeks to the punch on mathematics. Never mind that Persia and China had mastered differential equations while the Hellenic world was still figuring out triangles, it only counts when white people do it. So here's your shot. Alright, you're in 600 BCE. Go find something to draw with. Probably a clay tablet, or the sand at the beach, or whatever. Actually, make it clay. You're going to want to make sure that you get the credit, and clay lasts a whole lot better. Alright, you've got your slab of clay ready. Yeah? Good. Here we go. Draw a capital L. Yep, that's it. Capital L. You just invented geometry, but we are going to have to break that down for the normals. So you've got your capital L. Call one of the lines A and the other one B. Now connect the two ends of the L with another line. Call that C. What you've got there is a right angle triangle. You can now demonstrate that A squared plus B squared equals C squared.
The sum of the square roots of any two sides of an isosceles triangle is equal to the square root of the remaining side.
That's a right triangle, you idiot! Don't!
You've beaten Pythagoras to his theorem and invented scaling and similarity. You've proven that these areas will always be the same ratio no matter the size. It might seem like a small thing, but these are the shoulders of giants that Newton was talking about. Well, actually, when he said that, he was insulting Robert Hooke, but that's for another time. Congratulate yourself on basically inventing geometry. Humans can now navigate and build good bridges and survey land and build sloped roofs, all thanks to your invention of the triangle. Make sure that you take the credit. Pythagoras himself, or as he probably would call himself, Pythagoras, he's going to have to do something even cooler now to make history, because his theorem is now named after you. I hope that you have a cool name. You're going to have a lot of things named after you. You're going to want to have a cool name. If not, now's the time to come up with one, because you're now 3,000 years older than your parents. You can be whoever the hell you want to be. If you want to call yourself Theophilus Q X-Wing, now's your chance. While you're coming up with geometry, you're also going to want to come up with some standard measurements. If you're a patron, then you'll know why standard units of measurement are a good thing to have. If you're not a patron, then you should know that patrons get more shows than you do, and they'll have an edge if you ever find yourself in a time travel competition. Just a little something to think about. Alright, measurements. A, B, and C square will always line up, no matter what measurement you're using. But it's going to be a hell of a lot easier if everyone is singing from the same hymn book. And people throughout history are probably using some weird measurements, like cubits or hogsheads or a chain you found in your garden or some stupid shit like the length of three barleycorns placed end to end. That's what an inch is, by the way, three barleycorns end to end, if you're not a patron. So you want some standard measurements. Something that's going to be the same wherever you are, whatever you do. To do that, you need something that is always the same to be your base. Something that never ever changes. Something of a universal constant, you might say. What's something that we know is a universal constant? Something that is always the same? That's right, the speed of light in a vacuum. As we know, the speed of light in a vacuum never changes. It is always and forever 299,792,458 meters per second. Which is pretty quick. Probably a little bit too quick for you guys to get an accurate measurement of it in the Bronze Age. So we're going to have to MacGyver this.
Tonight on MacGyver, 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 MacGyver.
Get something with a bit of weight to it. It doesn't matter what, get a rock, whatever. Tie a rope to it. Now you have a pendulum. Good for you. Actually, no, take a moment and force people to acknowledge that you just casually invented the pendulum. Go and find Pythagoras and rub his face in it. Sucks to be you, I just invented the pendulum. It's alright, the guy was a dick, don't feel bad about it, rub his face in it. Any pendulum that takes 1 second to swing will cover 1 meter of distance. And don't worry about height, either. A cool thing about pendulums is that they take the same time to oscillate regardless of the angle that you start them off at. Does this seem outrageous to you? Go out and try it. Test it. Pendulums are cool. But Damo, you say. What if I've got a really tiny pendulum? Doesn't that mess with your calculations? Well, does this tiny pendulum take 1 second to swing? Of course not, it needs to be big enough to swing for 1 second, and that will always give you 1 meter. Any pendulum that takes 1 second to swing will cover 1 meter of distance. Pendulums are fucking cool. Make sure that there is some famous artist out there carving a statue of you because you invented the pendulum. That's how amazing they are. And if you're in the Hellenic era, then make sure that they give you a small dick. You're an intellectual. You don't want people thinking you've got some massive, dumb, barbarian dick. You want people to think that you're smart. But yeah, pendulums are awesome. They're constants. 1 second equals 1 meter. I know you guys hate it when I get too mathematical, so I'll say that there are some important caveats here that qualify all of these things, like friction, so it's not 100% correct 100% of the time to say that 1 meter equals 1 second, but you're in the distant past and nobody's going to pull you up on this shit because you just invented the concept and laid the groundwork for things like physics. You're going to be long dead before anyone figures out any flaws in your maths. Just make sure that if you do this, you do it before the late 1500s, because by then Galileo is going to work out some of this friction stuff. And that dude has already got plenty of things to take credit for. You don't want him getting this one either. Oh, and you can also take the pendulum idea to invent the grandfather clock, if that's something that you wanted to do. If you were so inclined. Hint, hint. Oh, and you're probably going to want some standardized weight measurements while you're at it too. You know, for good measure. I'm hilarious. Take your meter and cut it up into 100 equal pieces. Now you've got centimeters. Make something that is the size of 1 centimeter cubed, so a centimeter by a centimeter by a centimeter, and fill that with water. That's a gram. Now you can weigh things. If you want to get particularly funky, then you can take the amount of energy required to heat that water 1 degree, and we can call that a calorie. But we don't really need to get that funky. Let some other scientists do the heavy lifting on that one. Don't be greedy, leave something for Lord Kelvin to do. Alright, now that we've got some basic measurements, we can start doing some goddamn science. That's what we're here for. Kicking the human race off the tee and getting hoverboards happening sooner. While we're here, let's discover physics. Various people bandied around with the idea of physics throughout human history, but Newton's laws of motion are the current foundation of classical mathematics. So instead of Newton, you can invent these, and you can be the father of mathematics, and I'll even spare you from being hit in the head with fruit to do it. Go forth and invent physics. Technically, it's discover physics, not invent physics, but we're doing this whole thing as an ego trip, right? So it's invent. Newton's laws of motion are 3 universal constants. And they are thusly. Newton's first law, which is about to be renamed after you, so, again, I hope you have a cool name. So Theophilus Q. X-Wing's first law of motion is, an object in motion stays in motion unless acted on by a force. We take this for granted, but being from the future has a way of making us all kind of jaded. This idea is absolutely fucking groundbreaking. Why does the apple fall? Gravity. Why does it stop? Wind resistance, friction, Newton's head, that's an outside force. Would it keep going without any of these? Absolutely. Everything in the universe springs from this idea because you just defined inertia. An object in motion stays in motion unless acted on by an external force. Theophilus Q. X-Wing's second law, F equals ma. Force is equal to mass times acceleration. This one has gone through a few iterations over the years, Aristotle was actually the first one to suspect that the weight and speed of an object influenced how hard it hit, but he didn't know about friction. Galileo did, and he codified inertia, but he didn't really know how gravity worked as a vertical force. But then Isaac Newton came along and put it all together into one cohesive rule, except he's not going to be able to because you got in there first. F equals ma. Isaac Newton's / Theophilus Q. X-Wing's third law. When two bodies interact, they apply forces to one another that are equal in magnitude and opposite in direction. Or, more simply, for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Again, this might seem obvious, but it really isn't. Shoulders of giants. It's one thing to know that the gravity of the Earth is pulling you down, but it's another thing entirely to know that you are also exerting a gravitational force of your own that is pulling the Earth towards you. It isn't enough of a gravitational force to really do much, but it's there. And this distinction is really important because otherwise all the equations break down. So make sure that you take the goddamn credit for inventing it. Seriously, ever heard of a guy called Gottfried Leibniz? Exactly. And while you're at it, you might be tempted to become the bane of schoolchildren everywhere and invent calculus, but you need to get in before the late 17th century to do it. If you want to invent calculus, not only do you need to beat Isaac Newton to it, you need to do it before Isaac Newton becomes famous, as Gottfried Leibniz discovered. Because both of those dudes invented infinitesimal calculus separately on their own, but they disputed which one of them came up with it first. To solve this dilemma, Isaac Newton suggested that they both defer to the Royal Society as an arbiter, which then duly recognized that Isaac Newton, and not Gottfried Leibniz, was the inventor of calculus. And in an astonishing coincidence, the president of the Royal Society was Isaac Newton, which in no way influenced their objectivity when it came to determining who invented calculus. So like I said, you got to get in there before Newton becomes famous. But if you want to fuck with Isaac Newton as payback, then tell him that you're from the future, and it's totally possible to transmute lead into gold, and that he should absolutely keep pursuing his obsession with alchemy. And then sit back and have a good old chuckle at him. Alright, now that we've tamed mathematics, the building blocks of the universe, we're probably going to want to focus on health. The number one biggest thing you can do is boil your water. Well, fire generally, but we're going to assume that you've gone past caveman times and you know how to make fire, but the bow drill and the fire plow are going to make that happen if there's nothing handy like flint around. You know how Boy Scouts do it? Do that. Basically, you want friction. Get those atoms good and jumpy and fire is inevitable. It's just going to take a hell of a long time and a hell of a lot of effort. But hey, congratulations for starting civilization. Make sure you carve your name into a cave wall somewhere. And once you've got fire, you want to start cooking things. Cooking meat breaks down the proteins, meaning it takes less effort to digest it and is thus more nutritious. Making this happen basically makes you God, so be prepared to milk that for all it's worth. But assuming that you are post-Stone Age, the major thing that you're going to want to impress on people is to boil their goddamn water. There's a bunch of nasty bugs in there that need killing, so kill them first. There's a reason why societies that are big on tea and beer get the jump on everyone else. It's because they've boiled out all of the nasties in their water. So cut to the front of the line. Boil your goddamn water. Seriously, this is going to kickstart humanity by about at least a century. This one simple trick. Doctors hate him. If you go back in time any further than the invention of antibiotics, people are going to be dropping off left and right. The bodies will be hitting the floor like rain on a tin roof.
Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor.
So you're going to want to fix that. Infection is one of the major causes of people leaving this mortal coil, and the best way to fight infection is with antibiotics. The best antibiotic you're going to be able to come up with on your own is penicillin. Penicillin was only discovered by Alexander Fleming in 1928. So you've got a lot of history there where you can be the hero that saves mankind. Oh, and by the way, antibiotics only work on infections. They don't work on viruses because viruses are, you know, a completely fucking different thing to an infection. A lot of people don't seem to know this. We are truly living in an idiocracy, and that's probably why you traveled back in time in the first place, to fix the idiocracy. Anyway, infections, antibiotics, penicillin. How do you do it? It's not as hard as it sounds. Penicillin is actually made from mold. Specifically, it's made from the mold Penicillium notatum, so there's a clue in the name there. This mold isn't hard to come by, because it grows on food. So let some food go moldy, and then take a look at it under a microscope. Oh, and if you don't have a microscope, you're going to have to eyeball this, and it's going to be a real crapshoot, but let's assume that you do. Travel to ancient China or Persia. They've got great optics. You'll be fine. So look at your mold under a microscope. If you see something like the mold is waving at you with tiny little hands on really long arms, bingo, that's Penicillium notatum. Get some of that into your system, and it will prevent bacteria from forming cell walls and reproducing, killing it softly with its song. Congratulations, you just saved billions of people. You're probably the most important person who ever lived. Alexander Fleming really doesn't get enough credit. He gets a fair bit of credit, but it will never be enough because he basically saved the human race. That's a big deal. Anyway, Fleming is out because you invented penicillin, and there's no way that you're going to be as humble as he was, so take the credit. So you've just wiped out infections, and that's huge. But here's where you're going to hit the hardest part of your journey. Absolutely everything else, including splitting the goddamn atom, is going to be a hell of a lot easier than this next step. What you need to do is convince people that there are invisible monsters everywhere, and these invisible monsters are making them all sick. And this is going to be hard because there are people today who still don't believe this. So if you're going to go around claiming that there are invisible bugs, you're going to have a bad time. You will be locked up in an asylum where you will be abused until you die. Asylums aren't fun now, but today's asylums are absolute heaven compared to anything we had before. And this is exactly what happened to the Hungarian scientist Ignaz Semmelweis, one of the first people to promote germ theory. He tried to convince people that there are invisible bugs that make people sick, and he was declared insane and locked in an asylum where he was restrained in a straitjacket 24/7 in a dark room with no windows. His treatment was being hosed with cold water at random intervals and being fed a constant supply of castor oil so that he could shit out the demons. All of this because he said that germs existed and that doctors should probably wash their hands between handling a corpse and birthing a baby, which was something that happened a lot. And doctors were offended because they were gentlemen and a gentleman's hands are always clean. I'm not taking liberties here. That's exactly what used to happen, and that's exactly the quote that they used. In some truly cosmic irony, Ignaz Semmelweis cut his hand trying to escape from his straitjacket, germs got in the wound, it got infected, and he died of sepsis in an asylum. So if you're going to do germ theory, you've got that to look forward to. But the gears of civilization are greased with the blood of sacrifice or something like that, so you gotta do what you gotta do. And feel free to call them something other than germs. Germs is a dumb name, we're just used to saying it. Germ means to seed or to sprout, as in germinate, which is technically what they do, but it's a real missed opportunity. You've traveled back in time, you're discovering the theory, go nuts with the nomenclature. Call them micro-kaiju or politises or something. Think of the future. Be cool. Oh, and you're also probably going to want to sterilise any instruments that you use for surgery and whatnot. That should be a given, but it actually isn't. So sterilisation cuts down a lot of infection. Boiling your instruments works, Germs, like most living things, don't like being boiled. But what if you've got equipment that can't be boiled? Well, if you can't get it wet, then shoot steam at it, because germs, or microkaiju, like most living things, don't like being shot with superheated steam. And also, if you have something that can shoot superheated steam, it also works to get rid of people who try and lock you away for promoting germ theory. Because again, most things do not like being shot with superheated steam. Imagine if you saw that in your high school textbook. This is Dr. Damian Smith. He invented microkaiju theory and the Face Melter 5000. Substitute your name in there instead of mine if you beat me into the past. As I mentioned before, you're probably going to want to boil your water as well, because it's probably not clean considering that you've traveled backward in time. There are billions of microkaiju in there making people sick, and boiling your water will kill them good and proper. That's one of the best things that you can do for humanity at pretty much any point in history. Boil your water, congratulations, you just put a huge dent in cholera and typhoid. You're on a fucking tear, you goddamn hero, you. Oh, and you can also do this with milk, too. Milk is chock full of things that want to kill you. So if we can't boil milk, how do we get rid of all the microkaiju? Well, all is not bleak at the multiplex. If you heat milk up until it's almost, but not quite boiling, you'll still kill most of the nasty shit in it, but the milk won't turn funky. It'll remain milk. And it's at this point that I hope you have a really cool surname, because if you do this before 1864, you've just beaten Louis Pasteur to pasteurization. You've just invented X-wingization. Now all that kills 99% of germs. But germs are germs. Viruses are a whole different kettle of fish. Viruses are their own thing. Viruses are not a bacteria, so antibiotics do not work on them. I'll say it one more time, because people today still don't get it. Antibiotics will not work on a virus, because a virus is a virus. It's not a bacteria, it's not a fungus, it's not a parasite, it's not a prion, it's a virus. Viruses aren't actual living things in the sense that most life on Earth as we know it is living. Viruses can't reproduce on their own. When a mummy virus and a daddy virus love each other very much, no matter how hard they try, they can't make a little baby virus. So what they need to do is find a healthy cell from a living creature and infect that cell and turn it into a virus cell. So they're exactly like vampires. Vampires can't make babies, they're sterile, so they have to bite someone and turn them into a vampire. It's exactly the same deal with a virus. This is why things like horse dewormer do not work on them, and anyone who tries it is a fucking imbecile. Horse dewormer is for fighting horseworms, not viruses or vampires. The best way that we know of to get rid of viruses is to teach the body how to fight them. You get your body's immune system in the briefing room, and you show it a picture of the virus on a wanted poster, and you say to your immune system, "You see this guy over here? If you see this guy anywhere in your body, you fuck him up good and proper. You got me?" You know when you're watching a cop show and it comes over the radio, "Suspect is a Caucasian male, 5'6", black hair, wearing a top hat and a monocle," and the police see that guy and then they go and beat him up and arrest him? That's how vaccination works. Or maybe this. Let's say that you're a vampire hunter, and your mentor, Van Helsing, takes you into a basement and he shows you a dead vampire with a stake through its heart, and he says, "This is what a vampire looks like. This is how you kill them. You see one of these sparkly motherfuckers in the street, you give him a proper shanking with a stake." That's a vaccine. You get a little bit of the virus that you're trying to fight, and you grow it in a petri dish. And then you straight up murder it. You burn that virus like you're raining fire down on Charlie. You kill it dead. And then you take those dead virus cells and put them in a human body, and the immune system will go, "Hey, that looks like a virus. We'd better fight it. Oh wait, it's already dead. Cool. We'll do an autopsy on the corpse and discover the weaknesses so that if we ever see a live version of it, we'll kick the ever-loving shit out of it." So in a sense, you've just made your immune system into Van Helsing. You're not going to be immune to the vampires, though. This is crucial. But you will know how to fight them. It's kind of like how Tony Stark fixes his Iron Man suits so that the thing that got him last time won't happen again. You know how he has to carry the suit with him in Iron Man 2, and then in Avengers he has a suit that flies out and attaches itself to him to get rid of that weakness? Or Whiplash overloads him with electricity and his next suit can absorb Thor's lightning, or he's not fast enough to save War Machine so the next one has boosters, or he falls out of a space portal and now has a parachute. Everything that got him last time he fixes in the next suit. That's a vaccination. I have tried any number of analogies with these anti-vax imbeciles, and I will keep trying until one of them sticks. Speaking of viruses, since you're in the past, the number one virus you're going to want to get rid of is smallpox. Smallpox is pretty much public enemy number one, no matter which point in human history you find yourself in. Smallpox is fucking horrifying. I do not recommend Googling it. We wiped out smallpox in 1980, although the vaccine had been around for a couple of centuries before that. It took that long to kill this evil motherfucker, and now dickheads from Byron Bay are trying to bring it back. But I digress. You can vaccinate against smallpox using the Petri dish and fire technique, or you can use the method that Edward Jenner discovered in 1796. As it happens, smallpox, which affects humans, is very similar to cowpox, which affects cows. They're pretty much the same thing. Except one of them is deadly to humans, and the other is deadly to cows. But they're so similar that the human immune system cannot tell them apart. You find cowpox on cows, as you might expect. So go out, look at some cow's udders, it's not weird, and see if they display any boils that look like pox. That's cowpox. Now take some of that and put it in a human. The human is not going to have a fun time. They're going to get pretty sick, but they won't die from it. It won't be anywhere nearly as bad as actual smallpox. And then, when they get better, they'll have developed an immunity to smallpox. Their body will have been in a bar brawl with cowpox and beaten it with a pool cue. And then, when cowpox's brother smallpox comes around, the body will go, "Hang on, I know that guy. Get him, boys."
Manners maketh man. You know what that means.
That's how a vaccine works. The Latin word for cow is vaccus. Something that you get from a cow, which stops you from getting sick, is called a vaccine. Yeah, vaccine means from a cow. How many of you saw that coming? So that's how you wipe out most of the issues plaguing humanity. Oh, and if you can do this without experimenting on slaves, please try and do that. If we're getting a historical mulligan, we might as well try and be good people while we're at it. A lot of dudes in the original timeline, they weren't quite as enlightened. And you know what? While we're curing things, let's kick diabetes straight in the dick. If someone is frequently urinating or experiencing hunger or thirst, on suddenly losing weight, it could be lots of things. But it could be diabetes, which means they're going to die soon.
Diabetes and diet. Next you'll be telling me that leasing a sports car is a bad investment.
Unless you take a pig and tie a string around its pancreas. Then you can siphon off the goop that accumulates in there and inject it into this person, and they'll suddenly jump up like that lazy fucking Charlie in the Chocolate Factory. Yeah, pigs make insulin. They are truly a magical animal.
Yeah, right, he's a wonderful, magical animal.
But wait, there's more. Throughout most of human history, surgery was something that you avoided. In fact, quite a fair percentage of the population would opt for certain death rather than having life-saving surgery. This is because of the fact that the surgery would be done without anesthetic, which means that it was astonishingly painful. This, combined with the lack of antibiotics and the general filth that the surgeons walked around coated in, meant that certain death from something that you had was almost always preferable to almost certain death from infection after a horrendously painful procedure. So let's invent some anesthetic. The first readily available anesthetic was ether. To make ether, you want 4 parts ethanol to 1 part sulfuric acid. Hey, if this was easy to make, then someone would have done it before the 19th century. So what you want to do is take the... Okay, so I've had to think about this during the edit. If Joe Rogan is rightfully getting his shows taken down because of spreading medical misinformation, I'm guessing I probably shouldn't tell you guys how to make something that is both a potent date rape drug and a bomb. But if you already know your chemistry and you've traveled back in time anywhere before the 19th century, then the world's your oyster. Throughout history, anything that can dull the senses has been hot property, so you can get yourself ether rich. The guy that first came up with ether for anesthetic purposes was Crawford Long in the 1840s, but he was one of those magnanimous types that didn't want to patent his invention, so you've got heaps of time to capitalize on human misery by patenting ether. Or you can do what he did and make the world a better place, either or. And while we're at it, let's take something as simple as choking. If someone is choking, then you can grab them from behind by putting a closed fist just above their belly button, grabbing that fist with your other hand, and violently squeezing the shit out of them. You probably know this as the Heimlich maneuver. And it doesn't show up until 1982. Not 1882, 1982. The previous method for dislodging something in someone's throat was just slapping them on the back. And if you go back to the 1930s, the method before that was to just reach in and try and grab whatever they were choking on. Not only is there a good chance of you having your fingers bitten off, developing sepsis and probably dying because of the lack of antibiotics, you were actually also doing more damage to the person by pushing the choking hazard further into the windpipe. So Heimlich maneuver is the way to go. Only now it's the Theophilus Q X-Wing maneuver.
Lock air spoils in attack position.
Anyway, quite a few kings in history have choked to death, and they would probably be very grateful to a time traveler who helped them with that. So feel free to ask for a hefty reward. But what if you're not the healing type? What if you're more the mad scientist type? Well, I don't blame you. It's tempting. Well, if you want to be a mad scientist, there's a few ways that you can go about it. If you want to claim the idea of atomic theory, you're probably out of luck. Democritus was the first to come up with that in about 400 BCE, so it depends on how far down the time trousers you fell, but that doesn't mean that you can't do some seriously cool mad scientist shit. You can get a leg up on the opposition by knowing that atoms are made up of a core of nucleus and protons, which are positively charged. Spinning around them are electrons, which are negatively charged. Atoms with the same number of protons and neutrons are electrically neutral, or otherwise they are positive or negative, depending on their makeup. Like charges repel, opposites attract. Basic stuff. And this causes atoms to want to get to know each other and form compounds. We call how sociable these atoms are valence. This works for ideas, too. If you are neither for nor against something, you are considered ambivalent. Ambivalent. The number of protons decide what element the atom is. Hydrogen has 1 proton. Carbon has 6. Oxygen has 8 protons, 8 neutrons, and 8 electrons. Sometimes you can get these atoms cuddling up to each other to make other elements. For instance, when a silicon atom has an orgy with 4 oxygen atoms, you get quartz. You can then sell quartz to hippies and tell them that it will align their chakras, and they will believe it. You don't even need to travel back in time to do this, it still works today. Quartz has an interesting attribute unrelated to supernatural phenomena as well. It's what we call piezoelectric. Piezo means to squeeze, and electric means electric. Basically, if you hit quartz, it makes a little bit of an electric charge. To oversimplify, a quartz atom is perfectly balanced between positively charged protons and negatively charged neutrons, and they are in a perfect harmony, and if you hit quartz hard enough, you can slightly shift the balance of those itty-bitty atom pieces, meaning that one side of it is just a little bit more positive and the other side is just a little bit more negative. And if you were to, I don't know, have some wires there to channel that energy, you could make an electric spark. That's exactly how a lighter works. When you press the button, you start the gas flowing, and that really strong click is a small hammer hitting a bit of piezoelectric quartz, making a spark and lighting the gas. So you can use this to invent the lighter if you want. The inverse is true too. If you apply electricity to a piezoelectric crystal, you can deform it. You're probably not going to have the tools available to fine-tune this enough to be useful, but you can use this principle to create a battery-powered watch. That's what a quartz watch is. I really don't know how to break this down without spending at least 20 minutes explaining how you get a miniature tuning fork to vibrate at the precise frequency of a power of 2, and if you're listening to this in the past, then your phone's battery life is probably becoming your number one issue right now, but just sort of keep it in mind. But if you do manage to invent the quartz watch, set your new precision timepiece to London time. Then, measure the difference between local noon and London noon, and you've just calculated longitude. If you're in or around the year 1714, the British Crown has a cash prize of £20,000 for anyone who can do this, which is worth about $5 million in today money. So maybe you want to get onto that. The British are really big into sailing, and sailors like to know where they are on the planet, considering that the Pacific Ocean takes up more than half of it, so calculating longitude is important to them. Hence the £20,000 prize. Oh, and by the way, you should probably keep in mind that atoms and energy are kind of the same thing. If you pop an atom open, you get a crazy amount of energy, like making an artificial star amount of energy, so keep that in mind. This is easier said than done, but just keep the principle in mind, just in case. The idea is called energy mass equivalence, and if you want to look super smart, you can write it down as energy, or E, is equal to mass, or M, times the speed of light squared. Or you could simplify that to E equals MC squared. Suck it, Einstein! You should have invented a time machine. And you can kick this whole process off by finding some elements with a lot of neutrons. Heavily radioactive elements like plutonium or uranium are good for this, and then smacking them together as hard as you can, like firing them out of a gun at each other. Although I wouldn't recommend it, as it's probably going to be really bad for your health for a number of reasons, like radiation poisoning or the fact that you just invented the atomic bomb. Point away from face, you destroyer of worlds, you. Transmuting lead into gold has been the goal of alchemists throughout time. Everyone from Genghis Khan to Isaac Newton has wanted in on that secret. Because back in the day, people had no idea about the periodic table. They thought that the elements were the five things that made up Captain Planet. So because lead and gold had pretty much the same properties, they thought that they were the same thing. You could coach lead to get its act together, hit the gym, and become gold. You can't, because it's an entirely different element. But they didn't know that. Actually, it is possible to turn lead into gold. The fabled Philosopher's Stone does exist, in a sense. But I think that you're going to have trouble building a functioning particle accelerator in the Dark Ages, so I'm leaving it off this list. We can do it today, it's just not worth the effort. You do require a particle accelerator. So you can't turn lead into gold, but you can do something even better. You can create a metal that is way more valuable and expensive than gold. Aluminium. Or aluminum, if you're in the United States or Canada. And trust me when I say we don't want to go down that etymological rabbit hole on aluminium versus aluminum and Latin declension of French words, but in the 1800s, chemists literally came to blows regarding this. And as frequently happens in matters regarding spelling, a lot of it was caused because Noah Webster was a fucking lunatic, but that's a show for another time. For anyone wondering, aluminium is the accepted scientific term according to the international standard set by the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry, although they do begrudgingly recognize aluminum as an accepted variant. Alright, enough of a tangent. Aluminium, when it was first discovered, was a wonder metal. It's like, what if metal, but light? Which is kind of a big deal. Among other things, it made aviation possible. But when it came on the scene way back when, it was worth way more than gold. It was crazy expensive, because it wasn't easy to get. You don't just find some aluminium lying in a riverbed, you have to work for it. But Damo, you say, we have aluminium everywhere now. We use it for soft drink cans, and I throw them in the bin instead of correctly recycling them. Well, shame on you. But you're half right. Aluminium is easy to make now because of something called the Hall-Héroult process, which comes on the scene in 1888. If you travel back in time before this, then get set to become the richest person on the planet. Get yourself some bauxite. If you travel back in time to Australia, then fun on a bun, you're sitting on top of the world's largest supply of bauxite ore. Now you need some cryolite. That isn't as easy to come by, but there used to be a huge supply of it in Greenland. I say used to because aluminium is pretty popular, but if you're in the past, Greenland is just swimming with the stuff. Cryolite is used in glassmaking, so you should be able to get your hands on some, just as long as you didn't end up in the Copper Age or something. Now get some sort of receptacle and melt down your cryolite. Get it all liquid up in there. Now drop your bauxite ore in. Now what you want to do is run some electricity through that bad boy. Juice it up like you're a prison warden at Guantanamo Bay. Get those jumper cables pumping. And when you do, aluminium will drop to the bottom of the vat, and presuming that this is before the year 1888, you are now richer than God. But to do this, we need electricity. So the piezoelectric effect is a way to generate a little bit of electricity really quickly, but we want a lot of it on the reg. Where do you get it? Well, remember that episode of X-Men when Storm shot Magneto with lightning and Magneto just laughed? Yeah, that's because electricity and magnetism are the same thing. Like Hannah Montana and Miley Cyrus. And I hope that sticks because honestly all I know about that show comes from that single line of dialogue from Zombieland. Anyway, if you get an electric field moving, you get magnetism. If you can move a magnet around, you've got yourself some electricity. Boom. By the way, if you've got a magnet, it's always going to want to point north. Unless you somehow travel back more than 800,000 years in the past, then it's going to point south, but that's going to be the least of your problems at that point. And if you mount your magnet in a way that it can spin freely, you've got yourself a compass. Remember when Arthur C. Clarke said that any sufficiently developed technology is indistinguishable from magic? Well, you've got a rock that always points north. If you're far enough in the past, don't be humble. Go and found your own religion. Just try and make it inclusive. Anyway, back to electricity. Get yourself an iron rod and wrap it in copper wire, which shouldn't be hard to accomplish even in the Bronze Age. And if you can get electricity into this, you've got yourself an electromagnet. In the mother-flippin' Bronze Age! Oh, but you don't have electricity. Don't worry about that, that's easy. You just need a water wheel. Unless you teleported back further than the development of agriculture, you're probably going to find a water wheel anywhere there's running water. Put your magnet on the water wheel, the part that's moving, and your copper-wrapped iron ore next to it, and all of a sudden you're converting the mechanical energy of running water into electricity. Get enough of that going, and now you're the undisputed aluminium baron of the classical era. Go found yourself an empire. Oh, and while you're at it, you might as well formalize the theory of thermodynamics, because you're already a third of the way there. You've just changed mechanical energy into electrical energy and proven that energy can change from one form to another. You might as well formalize it and pad out your resume. Here's the three rules of thermodynamics. Energy can never be created or destroyed, only changed from one form to another. Entropy will never decrease, so basically you can never turn an omelette back into eggs. And the third law is all about entropy and absolute zero, and it doesn't really condense well into a soundbite, but Basically, it's the idea that everything will die one day. Even the universe. So maybe don't teach the kiddies that one just yet. Alright, maybe our electricity plan has hit a bit of a snag. What if you want to make a water wheel generator, but you don't have a magnet? You need magnets to make this happen. Alright, here's what you do. Iron, cobalt, and manganese are naturally magnetic in some fashion, so see if you can score yourself some of that. If you're using iron, then you want iron that has been through a superhero origin story, so go looking for places where lightning has struck and see if there's any iron ore there. That's going to be magnetic. Failing that, you can take some iron ore and heat it up to make a weak magnet, and then you can use that to comb through the beach looking for iron filings. Again, magnets. Put all of it together and you've got electricity now. Poor Michael Faraday is probably going to die as a hobo because you beat him to the punch, you monster. And if you don't know how to write any of this in nice, sexy mathematics, then you can go and find James Clerk Maxwell to do all of the code for you, because that's what Michael Faraday did. Oh, and since you've got electricity, do you want to invent the light bulb? That's probably something you should do, right? The light bulb is one of those benchmark things. You need something with a super high melting point. The metal with the highest melting point is tungsten, so use tungsten. Run a current through tungsten and get it super hot, put it in a glass bowl, and you've got a light bulb. The reason for tungsten is you want something that can get hot enough that it becomes incandescent, as in it glows. And most things will either melt or burn when they get that hot, but tungsten won't. And anything that is super duper hot will give off light as a byproduct. There's the first law of thermodynamics again. Isn't it great that you invented that? But even tungsten isn't going to cut it on its own. Warren Delarue is going to figure out that you should suck all of the air out of the bulb first and have a vacuum so that there's nothing to react with. And if you get in before 1840, you can beat him to that. Oh, and if you want to get super fancy, then by filling your light globe with noble gases, like xenon or argon or neon or something, will mean that it won't explode, but it also won't implode under the pressure either. Science. Thomas Edison is going to be way behind the eight ball here too. He's going to be peddling bulbs with cotton filaments that last 12 hours, 18 hours tops, so you can just get in there and blow that fucker out of the water with your lasting many, many years light globes. Get in there and just decimate Thomas Edison. He deserves it. He's a dick.
It was Thomas Edison, Dad. I thought he invented the light bulb. That too. He also invented the photograph, the microphone, and the electric car.
No one man can do all that. You're a liar, honey. A dirty, rotten liar.
Nobody is going to figure out tungsten until the 1890s, so you've got time to put your feet up for a bit if you want. But you will want to do it before the 1920s, because there's going to be an actual real conspiracy of people who make light bulbs. The so-called Phoebus Cartel, who are going to make it their business to keep light bulbs from getting too efficient, so that they'll always have a demand for light bulbs. There you go, an honest-to-God real conspiracy for you. Look it up, Phoebus, P-H-O-E-B-U-S, Greek deity of light. The Phoebus Cartel is a real thing that existed. See, I'm kind of like Joe Rogan, but my show actually deals in facts. Now, I mentioned Thomas Edison, and depending on where you are in history, Thomas Edison is probably going to try and take credit for everything.
A dirty, rotten liar.
But hopefully you've got a track record of inventing anything worth inventing, and his word won't mean shit, but that doesn't mean he won't try. So fuck that guy.
Edison was just like me.
You mean the wild mood swings?
Alright, well, we're still playing with electricity. Run enough of it along a wire back and forth really quickly, and you've got yourself a radio. Now remember how electromagnetism works both ways? That's how you get transmitters and receivers. There are two ways to blast out a signal. You can modulate the strength of the signal, or amplitude if you will. This is amplitude modulation, and it is referred to as AM. Or you can change how quickly the signal moves up and down. This is frequency modulation, or FM. While you're deciding which system to use, keep in mind that AM requires a lot more power and has a much shorter range. Oh, and here's something fun. If you accidentally touch an AM broadcast tower, That is probably one of the worst possible ways to die, so don't touch it. What happens is the power modulation syncs up with the human muscle contractions, meaning that the more electricity that runs through your system, the harder that you're going to grip onto the tower, so you're physically incapable of letting go. And this also means that you will, in your own small way, be broadcasting that same frequency through your skeleton and your muscles. You try to scream, but all that comes out is Christian rock.
He cocked that crooked hammer back and he brought that hammer down.
Exactly, the bones are the skeleton's money. In our world, bones equal dollars. That's why they're coming out tonight to get their bones from you.
All you can hear is that station because it is being beamed directly into your skull in those few moments before you die. So try not to touch an AM tower with your bare hands. But while we're on radio, here's a fun trick you can do with a radio transmitter. If you take two or more radio signals and measure how long it takes them to get to somewhere and then bounce back, and whether they bounce back to you in a uniform fashion or not, if they don't, that means that there's something in the way, and you can tell how far away that thing is and if it's moving or not. This is called radio detection and ranging. Today we just shorten that to radar. Take the credit. And you can do the same thing with sound if you want. We call it sonar. But you invented it, so come up with a cooler name. Call it bat vision or something. Anyway, this basically wins the Second World War for whoever invents it, so I sincerely hope that you're not a Nazi. Once upon a time I would have assumed that you weren't as a matter of course, but these are troubling times we live in. Alright, enough of that. Let's kick off the Industrial Revolution early. That means we're going to need steel. As I've said in a previous show, iron is actually a relatively shitty metal. In the today times, we're spoiled by good iron. We've got steel, and we tend to think that we've always had steel. This isn't the case. Iron used to be a bit of a crapshoot. Iron has the problem of rusting, oxidization. That's why for the longest time, the best iron that you could get was the stuff that you found in meteors, because there's no oxygen in space, ergo no oxidization. You can't find decent iron anywhere on the Earth's surface because of this. It's all rusted. You need to dig for good iron. So in complete layman's terms, iron has different qualities. The quality is determined by how much carbon is in the iron ore. Anything above about 2% carbon is called cast iron. That carbon content makes the iron harder, but it also makes it more brittle. This means that it's fine for things that don't take a lot of punishment, like cookware, but you don't want to be building bridges or cannons out of it. Less carbon in your iron, ideally less than about 1%, is wrought iron. This means that the iron is more ductile, you can shape it better and it doesn't crack under pressure like cast iron, but it doesn't have the same tensile strength either. And incidentally, the largest structure in the world made out of wrought iron is the Eiffel Tower, which has been painted 17 times to stop it from rusting. So you might have noticed a discrepancy with the percentages there. Anything above 2% carbon is cast iron, anything under 1% is wrought iron. That means that there's an entire percentage point not accounted for. And this is the Goldilocks zone. This is the money percentage. If there was a way that you could get iron with exactly that much carbon in it, you could have all the benefits of both with none of the weaknesses. A strong, hard metal that is also loosey-goosey when you need it to be. Oh, wouldn't that be grand? So what you want to do is heat the iron so that it's hot enough that all of the impurities in it melt away, but not hot enough that the iron itself melts. This isn't as easy as it sounds, and throughout history, humans have done it with varying levels of success. Some people are really bad at it, the Saracens and the Japanese were particularly good at it, but there's a broad spectrum. I'm not going to do a chemistry lesson here, so I won't go into blast furnaces and the ingredients thereof, but if you've traveled in time, you'll be able to significantly advance human civilization by remembering that you can make iron better by making it really, really hot, so you can burn out all of the impurities. But this will give you cast iron. So what you need to do is let it cool down and then heat it up again, this time not quite so hot, and conduct a process known as fining. where you bash the ever-loving shit out of your iron with a hammer to get rid of the excess carbon. And a place that you would do fining would be known as a refinery. And doing this makes steel. But as you might have guessed, all of this takes a lot of time and resources and manpower. Steel is very expensive at any point in human history until less than 200 years ago. You don't get things like steel nails and screws and bolts because of how damn expensive they were to make. You needed to save your steel for more important things like battleships and cannons. So how do you make cheap steel? Well, you get yourself a huge kettle. Think 2 meters tall, with holes in the bottom of it that you can pipe hot air through. And you've not only made a blast furnace, you've made what's known as a Bessemer converter. The British inventor Thomas Bessemer invented this in 1855, but you can get in earlier. Get your iron nice and hot and watch the top of your kettle. There'll be a blue flame. This is carbon monoxide. We're burning that nasty carbon out of the iron. When that blue flame dies out, you add an alloy of iron, manganese, and silicon called spliegleisen. Get all of that nice and hot, and then pour in some limestone to draw out any phosphorus, which is going to make your iron brittle, and cook all of that together, and in about 20 minutes, you've got good quality cheap steel. You've just made high-grade steel very quickly. The human race will skyrocket after this. Literally, in about 100 years, we'll be on the moon, so make sure you take the goddamn credit. But what if you're not the credit-taking type? What if you're not about these grand, sweeping inventions that change the course of human history? What if you want to do something simple? If you want to do something understated yet incredibly practical, you could invent the humble zipper. It's not flashy, but it has made the lives of billions of people much easier. And I'm not being flippant, we need these little victories. And to make a zipper, all you need to do is attach some small interlocking metal teeth to a cloth strip and then force them through a wedge that either compresses or separates them. You, armed with your future knowledge as you are, you know how a zipper works, so invent it. The zipper proper doesn't get invented till about 1917, although the idea was floating around since the mid-1800s, so you've got a damn good shot at actually inventing the zipper. Although I am willing to bet that you don't have as cool a name as the people behind the invention of the zipper. Guys like Whitcomb Judson and Gideon Sunback. They don't name them like they used to, so I hope you're running by the name of Theophilus Q. X-Wing. And before you go mocking the idea of inventing zippers, there's money in it. There's a shitload of money in it. Maybe you don't want to be famous, maybe you just want to be rich. Well, the zipper is where it's at. Take a look around now and find a zipper. Go through your house, find a zipper. It's alright, you can pause the show. Go and find a zipper. Right, you found one? Good. Take a look at it. Does it have the letters YKK printed on it? There is a better than 50% chance that it does. YKK stands for Yoshida Kogyo Kabushiki Gaisha, or the Yoshida Manufacturing Corporation. That's right, most of the world's zippers are monopolized by one company. There's some serious cash to be made. But you're not into zippers. Okay, that's cool. You know what's never gone out of style? Lumber.
Lumber has a million uses.
Where do you get it? Trees. So how about you invent ways to make chopping up trees easier and much more efficient, and using that you can kickstart the age of sail. Depending on where you've landed in history, you can stagger your inventions to make yourself seem even more awesome. But they all have to do with chopping up trees. Let's say you're in the Dark Ages. Take an axe and then stick another axe on the top of that. This is what we call a double bit axe, and you've just doubled how long it takes for the axe to need sharpening. This means that Dark Ages peasants can spend longer out in the woods chopping down trees before needing to sit down and sharpen their axes. Trust me, they'll love you for doing this. Once the shine is worn off this invention, it's time to invent the saw. Take a blade, cut some teeth in it, that's a saw. A saw cuts both ways, more efficient. This makes it easier to cut wood and it eliminates wastage. Kings will love you for this. If you then take that saw and make it a circle and figure out a way to spin it, that's a circular saw. How do you get the power to do this? Well, you know how gears work and change the direction of force. Use your imagination. You'd be amazed at how long all of these things took to invent. So get in there and do it first. Now, you might be tempted to fuck around with things like plastic and nylon and whatnot. And I see where your head's at. They're wonder materials. But to get them, you need petroleum. And petroleum is going to be a tad beyond you as a solitary time traveler to acquire. So seriously, just don't. Don't dick around with petroleum. Stick with things that aren't going to blow you up. To make petroleum, basically, you need to travel to a part of the world that, no matter which point in human history you travel to, is going to be at war. And then you need to fight your way through a desert, making sure not to die in the desert, and then somehow dig through the sand until you find a liquid dinosaur. Then you need to suck that liquid dinosaur out of the sand and filter it into its constituent parts using heat and pressure in a way that this highly volatile compound doesn't explode at any point in the process. Seriously, it is not worth the effort. Especially when you can just go and find some mathematicians in this area and say, hey, do you want to see something really cool? I've got a new number for you. It's called zero. And watch everyone lose their shit. So that's all the big stuff that I can think of. And it's more than enough to make you the greatest person in history. If you're looking for other stuff that is going to help the human race, then the ballpoint pen is a big one. Inventing that means that left-handed people are finally able to write. So that's a big one. The humble fork might not spring to mind, but that doesn't show up until the collapse of the Roman Empire. Oh, and speaking of springing to mind, springs. Your knowledge of potential energy means that you can probably invent the spring, so go and do that. Good for you. The possibilities are endless. If you've traveled through time with this podcast and you've landed anywhere before the 1850s, you've just instantly become the most important person in history. But no matter when you turn up, just stop, pause, take a look around. See where something isn't, and just make it happen. Shoot your shot. I believe in you. Oh, and be warned that you are probably going to be killed for some kind of heresy. So keep that in mind. Maybe frame yourself as a prophet or a messiah or something so that all of this good stuff isn't an application of science but the divine will of the Almighty coursing through your veins. That's a good way to get around it. That's how Jesus started. He was just some dude from a community college in the 60s that fell into a time vortex. Not a lot of people know that. Just be sure to play it cool. Don't be a smartass. Be cool. I'll leave you with one cautionary tale that possibly has its roots in actual history, but has long since passed into myth, and it concerns the invention of the game of chess. I'm telling this tale as it's told by the 13th century Islamic scholar Ibn Khalikan, and I'm paraphrasing from memory here, but it goes something like this. There was once a sultan of Persia who grew bored, and he proclaimed a contest to all of the people in his great empire. If anyone could create something that could keep this sultan entertained for even a mere hour, that person would receive anything they wished for. And all of the musicians and the actors and the writers and the inventors from far and wide found their way to the sultan's court, and they each of them presented to the sultan wonders the likes of which the world had never seen before. And at each of these marvels, the sultan turned up his royal nose and, moved on. Until at last he came upon an old man, crouched by a checkered board. Intrigued, the sultan asked, what this seemingly innocuous thing, surrounded by such grand works of art and science and miracles and marvels, what this humble board was. And the old man explained the rules of chess, and the two of them played a game. And another, and another, and another, until at long last the Sultan realized that the sun had long since set and once again risen, and they'd spent that entire time playing chess. Delighted, the Sultan proclaimed that the old man had won his contest and won it well. "Make your wish," said the Sultan. "Anything in my power, and I will see it granted." And then the old man who invented chess made his wish. He asked the Sultan that a single grain of rice be placed on the top left square of the chessboard, and then for 2 grains to be placed on the next square, and 4 on the next, and 8, doubling with every square. And the Sultan roared with laughter. "I would have granted you anything in my empire, and you ask for grains of rice, you foolish old man. Then grains of rice you shall have." And with that, the Sultan ordered his vizier to bring a sack of rice to honor the old man's wish. And on the first square, they placed a single grain of rice. And on the second, 2 grains of rice. Then 4, then 8, then 16, then 32, and so on. And it was at this point that the problems with exponential growth became quite apparent. The old man wasn't so foolish after all. To cover an entire 64-square chessboard in this manner would require 446 quadrillion, 744 trillion, 73 billion, 709 million, 551,615 grains of rice, or slightly less than 1.5 trillion tons. More rice than existed in the world, and certainly more than enough rice to bankrupt even a mighty empire such as that of Persia. The Sultan, however, he was just as clever as this old man, and he found a different solution to the problem, and the old man's head was swiftly removed from his shoulders. So if you do find yourself traveling back in time, remember, discretion is the better part of valor. Did you get all of that down? Good. Go make history. And if you want to thank me, then feel free to go ahead and put some money in an account for me somewhere so that I can have a few centuries of compound interest. Or buy some shares in an up-and-coming tech company. I hear that there's a couple of nerds building something in a garage in Albuquerque who might need some seed money. I know it sounds risky, but I've got a good feeling about this, Microsoft. Trust me. Oh, sweet Jesus, this show was hard to record. I had everything set up, I was about to hit record, and just as my hand hovered over the button, my next-door neighbors decided to have a rather raucous party, as you do at 9 p.m. on a Monday. I swear I am getting more and more convinced that there's some sort of Ed Harris-type figure sitting in a control room in the sky waiting for me to try and record this show, and he's hyped himself up to record. Cue the tornado!
As Truman grew up, we were forced to manufacture ways to keep him on the island.
I'd like to be an explorer, like the Great Magellan.
Oh, you're too late. There's really nothing left to explore.
All right, Space Cowboys, you know how the outro goes. If you like what this show is about, then the best way to support it is over on Patreon. For as little as $1 a month, 4 games of Galaga, you can help me keep putting out product. As they say in RoboCop,
I'd buy that for $1.
Of course, you can pay more and get awesome stuff like bonus shows, but I'm not a hustler. I'm just going to tell you that it's there if you want it. As ever, it would help me tremendously if you could tickle the algorithm in my favor. So cheeky like, subscribe, review, share. Any buttons that you can click are very helpful to me. And not right now, as of the release of this show, but in the very near future, over on smirkfromhome.com, we're going to be bursting forth with new content like a facehugger, so keep an eye out for that in the not so far from now. If you feel like casting your own pod, then I highly recommend doing that through Podbean. They're who I use, and I am enjoying the service, and if that's something that you're interested in, then you can check out podbean.com/hgtfree. That's podbean.com/hgtfree, and I can hook you up with all kinds of discount there, so exciting. And one last order of business. If you're anything like me, and if you're listening, then I have a fair amount of faith in that assumption, then you know that there just isn't enough content out there. Demand far outpaces supply. You're saying, Damo, I like learning about history, but you're only putting out one show a month, or two for patrons. That's not enough. And Uncle Dan Carlin's only putting out shows on a biannual basis. What am I to do for content? Well, fret not. If you like learning cool things about history, and you want those things you learn to be presented in a sharper fashion than my rambling tangents, then why don't you go and wander over to a show called History's Train Wrecks? History's Train Wrecks back catalogue is like some kind of freaky mirror of topics that I've always intended to cover in this show, but I haven't quite gotten around to yet, and I do intend to do it in the future, and it's kind of like we both got inside that spinning thing from Tenet, and we're both doing history podcast shows from opposite sides of entropy, and we're going to meet in the middle at some point, and that reference is only going to make sense to the other 12 people who watched Tenet, but I am sticking by it. Anyway, History's Train Wrecks, don't take my word for it, here's a trailer.
The History's Train Wrecks podcast that focuses on stories like a temper tantrum that changed history, the president who promised not to run again and regretted it for the rest of his life, the World War II general who lost his pants on a secret mission in enemy territory. The History's Train Wrecks podcast, available now.
I know, right? A trailer. We're going full-on profesh here. Check it out. Does that fancy your tickle? Damn straight, get on it. That's all from me.
In case I don't see ya. Good afternoon, good evening, and good night.